Friends James Cooper and James Cazares were two 20-something college buddies from Great Britain in the middle of a three-week vacation in Sarasota, Florida, a place renowned for its white sand beaches and warm Gulf waters. The British tourists took advantage of the nightlife, too, bar hopping in downtown Sarasota on April 16, 2011. It was 2 a.m., and the establishments were closing down for the night. No party can last forever, even in paradise. The hours of bar hopping took its toll on the men. Carly Brownfield, a bartender at the Gator Club, testified that one of the men was so intoxicated, he rested his head on the bar for a moment. When the Gator Club closed, the two men staggered out and headed north, the opposite direction from the condo they were supposed to be staying at, closer to the beach. Were they drunk and lost? Or perhaps looking to buy some marijuana? It was a mystery as to why they ended up at the Courts, an old run-down housing project in one of the poorest parts of the city, with a long, complicated history of segregation. This neighborhood was a place few tourists ventured to, and certainly not at this hour. Here's Robert Eckhart, who was a reporter at the time for the Sarasota Herald Tribune.
At the center of the whole case was this terrible thing that's always haunted Sarasota. It's segregation, you know, and it's a small place. And so, you know, these guys were downtown at Smokin' Joe's drinking in downtown Sarasota. They walked, 10 or 12 blocks north and were in an extremely poor neighborhood, public housing, and just a whole different side of Sarasota that Sarasota has never, has never quite figured out how to lift up that neighborhood and how to, care for it.
21-year-old Nakira Kino would later testify that she was driving in her white Toyota Avalon with her friends when the sight of the two white men, their shirts off, caught her attention. They were just standing there, like they were waiting to buy drugs, she said. The tourists weren't alone. Nakira noticed two young black males. One was shirtless too and wore a black hat and a red bandana over his nose and mouth. The second young man wore a white shirt and jeans. The pair were about the same height. The man with the bandana kept his hand in his pocket, as if he was holding something as he approached the two white men. Nakira didn't see what happened next. She kept driving. At a stop sign, she turned the radio down. She heard multiple gunshots. So did other neighbors. It was around 3 a.m. when authorities received a frantic 911 call.
Hello?
Hi.
Yes.
Okay, you said he was a white male.
Oh, no, that's so terrible. Yes, he's laying on the ground. I think he's dead, ma'am. I don't know. We just rolled through the...
By the time police and fire officials reached the scene, James Cooper and James Cazares were dead, lying on either side of the street in the grass. Later on in a courtroom, Sarasota County Assistant State Attorney Karen Fravelig recreated their final moments for the jury. James Cooper and James Cazares' last words that they will ever speak on earth were, "Just leave me alone. Please let me go home. I'm drunk. I'm just trying to find my way home," the prosecutor said. James Cooper, 3 days past his 25th birthday, had been shot 4 times. The fatal shot went through his rib cage, through his left lung, and then came to final rest in his heart. James Cazares, 24, was shot twice in the back. The crime scene seemed peculiar, with the two men in various stages of undress. Both men were shirtless and had their pants and belts pulled down to their mid-thighs. And whoever had killed the two men hadn't taken anything, police said. The British men were found with their wallets, a digital camera, a cell phone, and more than $100 in cash between them. James Cooper still wore his Armani watch on his wrist. In the ongoing months, the mystery as to why the two men visited the housing projects wouldn't be solved. The medical examiner determined they had been shot with .22 caliber bullets. James Cooper's blood alcohol content was 0.214 and James Cazares's was 0.243. In Florida, people are considered too impaired to drive if their blood alcohol content reaches 0.08. The splashy headlines of two tourists shot in cold blood in an apparent botched robbery at a world-renowned vacation spot appeared in the New York Times and the BBC, as well as in the British tabloids on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean.
It was a big case. We had a lot of them in Sarasota. When I think back on, I spent about 15 years there, and there were a lot of big press cases. This was one of the bigger ones, partly just because it was so horrific, and also because it involved two English citizens.
Losing their only child, James Cooper, had destroyed them, wrote his parents, Stan and Sandy Cooper, in a statement to the court. His father had a heart attack. They couldn't sleep through the night. They read his diary, where James once revealed he wanted to get married and become a father one day. They watched James's friends celebrate their milestones and thought of all their son had missed out on in his short life. James Cazares, who had just returned from teaching English in Taiwan, loved to travel. His passion was meeting people and seeing new places. With a master's degree in planning, he had a bright future ahead of him, his parents would tell the court in their victim impact statement. Today, we're going to take a deeper look into this case that made headlines, not only in Sarasota, Florida, but beyond. We'll look into the history of where it occurred, how it was covered in the media, and if any of this affected the outcome. Would it be an open and shut case, or were there more complex factors at play? This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 124. Nobody saw who pulled the trigger. The murder weapon was gone, and many of the neighbors were reluctant witnesses. Their statements kept changing. Here's how the lead detective, Sarasota Police Detective Jonathan Todd, explained the challenges in his investigation. Quote, "The witnesses in this case, you have to keep in mind, were all close friends with the defendant. They were initially very hesitant to talk to police, to us, investigators, in any way to rat him out or snitch on him. These guys don't want to be labeled a snitch. It's certainly not a good thing to have that label, especially in this neighborhood." Sarasota police eventually arrested their suspect, 16-year-old Sean Tyson, who lived just 200 yards away from the crime scene. Sean, who was barely old enough to legally drive, was notorious for robbing tenants at gunpoint in the courts, according to the probable cause affidavit. Tattooed on his chest was the word savage.
I talked to his mom, and, she was just horrified by the tattoo that he had gotten on his 16th birthday. It was like savage, the word savage in 2-inch block letters right across his chest. And, no mom wants to see that on their son. And that was really a sad thing, that was what he wanted to walk into, or that was what he thought he was walking into with these guys that he was hanging out with.
Sean's mom felt like she was in a tug of war as her son hung out with an older crowd in the neighborhood, whom she feared were a bad influence on Sean.
Sean Tyson had a big family in Newtown. His grandpa was a pastor. He had in place the support system that you would want, for a kid to come up well. Of course, they were terrible poor, and his mom just didn't really know. I'm not making this up. She testified to this. She just didn't really know where he was all the time because he was out the house and running around with these older kids.
Police released the timeline of events that led to the shootings. Sean had been in custody at the juvenile detention facility for an unrelated incident and then was freed into his mother's custody at the courts on April 15th, a mere hours before the tourists arrived in his neighborhood. But it was a mistake. The court system had made an error. Sean should not have been let go from juvenile detention since he was already charged with aggravated assault stemming from an April 7th incident, just 9 days before the tourists were killed. Sean had fired at a fleeing car following a neighborhood confrontation, according to documents. Since he had been released and two people were dead hours later, the juvenile court system was under scrutiny. A veteran juvenile prosecutor resigned soon after.
He should have never been there in the first place. He should have been in the juvenile detention facility. People made mistakes. The prosecutors made mistakes. I think a judge made a mistake. I mean, there was plenty of blame to go around in that situation, but he should have never been on the street in the first place.
Sean rode with his mother to face questions from detectives on April 17th. The interrogation was recorded. Sean wouldn't testify at his trial, but his words during the interview were played back for jurors to hear.
Tell me why you think you're down here.
Sir, I really don't know.
I'm sure your mom told you something.
Look, how'd you get down here? Your mom bring you?
Yes, sir.
Okay. She drove you down here?
Yes, sir.
You guys didn't talk about it on the way down? What we talked to her about when we talked to her a couple of hours ago? She just said the police want to talk to you. Come on down to the police station. Nothing happened at home earlier or anything like that. You don't know anything that happened at your mom's house or nothing like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. She said, okay. Yeah, police ran up in the. I don't know for what. Sean, come on, man. You can't tell me that you came all the way down here and she didn't tell you what was going on. Yeah, she said that they trying to kill me, but I guess them two bodies what was found in the private. Okay. I was in the house the whole time. She knew I was in the house. She came and woke me up and said that they found, it was two people shot on the back road.
Okay.
Sean denied ever leaving his house that night. The detectives didn't believe him.
You might be able to pull the wool over your mom's eyes, like you were in there sleeping. But when people see you and identify you and know you by name,
who don't know me over there?
I'll tell you who does. The people saw you crawl back in that damn window.
Come on, man. You can't tell me.
I can't.
You think you're down here? You think you're down here because we feel like just bringing you down here and talking to you about this?
You're a hard ass. Huh?
You're gonna have a rude awakening, man.
You're a hard ass.
No, sir.
You better get hard then. You better harden up because you're in the big leagues now, partner.
This ain't home detention.
Yeah, you ain't going home.
So you can go out on the porch and see your lady friend. There ain't gonna be none of that.
This is your opportunity to tell us what happened out there.
Let me finish. If you weren't
by yourself, now is the time to tell me. You will not get another opportunity.
This is your story. Whatever you tell us now is the story. And we can prove that you're lying about that. How's that make you look?
So you never left your house all day?
No, sir.
One of the detectives would later say that Sean's face changed in the interview when they confronted him with evidence. Police had found 22 caliber bullets when they stormed his bedroom. They were the same size bullets that had killed the tourists.
Who were you out there with?
Really?
Nobody, sir.
That's bullshit. Who were you out there with?
Lord.
Nobody, sir.
Are you going to take the ride on us? All by yourself?
Sir, I'm telling you the truth. I want to nobody.
Are you going to take the ride for this all by yourself?
All right. So it was just you. You went out and murdered those two guys for no reason. You were all by yourself.
You're all by yourself?
Well, not me, sir.
It was you. I'm sure it was.
The lead detective testified during the trial, quote, up to that point, he'd been very confident, adamantly denying, as you could see, being out of the house, really sticking to his story. When I started mentioning the bullets, his demeanor changed. It was remarkable. He got very quiet. His lip, bottom lip, started to tremble. And his eyes started to water as if he was going to start to cry. The prosecutor followed up. Did you see tears form? I did, the lead detective said. It was also perhaps a reminder that the defendant was still a teenager. How could a 16-year-old be accused of such a cold-blooded crime? Who was Sean Tyson? Court records showed Sean attended a Sarasota public school, that was out of the mainstream education and taught students with disabilities and behavior problems. He had a severe learning disability and struggled with his reading especially. Sean had a, quote, emotional/behavioral disability that made it difficult for him to focus in the classroom. According to his many write-ups, he laughed at other students, stole small items, got into fights and refused to obey the school rules. He wouldn't pull his sagging pants up. He was defiant. He was also interested in guns. A teacher caught him looking at a website of handguns and automatic assault rifles. Sean's mother, who had raised him on her own, was sent notices annually of his long string of unexcused absences. He dropped out but wanted to go back to school in the ninth grade, he told police. Court documents indicate what was likely playing into his motivation to finish his education. Sean was going to be a father. When Sean thought of the future, he wanted to go to trucking school and become a semi-truck driver, according to school documents. Sean's sister wrote a letter to the court and complained Sean wasn't like the person depicted in the media. Sean's grandfather was a pastor, so her brother grew up in the church. He was good at football. He had been popular. Irene Sullivan is a retired Florida judge who handled cases such as juvenile delinquency, dependency, and domestic violence. Now, she teaches at Stetson University in Central Florida. Through her long career in juvenile law, she came up with her own mantra, a philosophy she wants her law students to always remember when working in cases involving young people.
Well, I developed it while working as a juvenile judge, and I've been using it for the 10 years that I've been teaching juvenile law. Because I start the class off by saying, you know, you all probably disagree on many things, but there's 100% agreement on this point that everyone has been a kid. And of course, they all nod, all 100% of my students, because they've all been kids, right? So then I go into the mantra, which is number one, kids are not short adults. Two, kids do stupid things. Three, kids need a responsible parent or parents, plural. And four, kids need to feel safe, to be loved, and to have hope.
Prosecutors decided to charge Sean as an adult with two counts of first-degree murder. If he was convicted, he was too young to face the death penalty, but he could be sentenced to life in prison. When Sean's name was released to the public, the media coverage only intensified. Gunned down in the ghetto, one British tabloid's headline read.
And they very much covered us like a foreign country. The whole time, you know, these other voices are kind of out there saying stuff that's a little bit different. You know, everybody from the AP to the Guardian, everyone called Newtown in Sarasota a high crime place, crime ridden, you know, a lot of those kinds of words. As they tried to kind of explain this unfathomable thing that happened to these two tourists who literally just wandered into the wrong place at the wrong time and you know, got killed.
It seemed like a threat to Sarasota's tourism-friendly image. Sarasota's Siesta Key was regularly named one of America's most beautiful beaches. Tourism played a major part of Sarasota's economy as retirees from the Midwest, spring training fans, and international travelers from the United Kingdom and the rest of Europe came to this subtropical paradise. Celebrities like horror writer Stephen King and rowdy television show host Jerry Springer owned mansions in Sarasota. It was a city of wealth.
Sarasota is a city on the Gulf of Mexico in southwest Florida. It's a city that really presents itself as paradise, as a place for vacationers and retirees, mostly focused on a service industry. It's part of Sarasota County and historically part of Manatee County.
That's how Sarasota professor Uzi Baram describes the community. Professor Baram teaches at New College of Florida, a liberal arts school located 3 miles from where the shootings occurred. As an anthropology professor, Professor Baram studies issues looking deeper at race and heritage and researched Sarasota's history. He traces back the racial divide in the city.
And to use the kind of common words, most whites across Sarasota moved here. They came from elsewhere. There's a stat that about 75% of the population in Sarasota County went to high school somewhere outside of Florida. So it's people who came here and came here to enjoy the heat, the sunshine, the beaches, the recreational opportunities. The exception to that is there's a small population, only about 5% of Sarasota County itself, that's African American. And the majority of that population is multi-generational. And so how people understand history for this area does have a racial divide, where for many African Americans, they have stories from their parents, great-grandparents, sometimes great-grandparents and beyond, while for most of the folks who we just commonly refer to as white, they made the choice to live here and live in houses that were built, if not for them, not too many decades before they moved in. So there's a newness versus a deep-seated heritage that's part of the racial divide here.
Compared to some cities in the Deep South, Sarasota's history was progressive, the professor said. In the 1900s, African Americans couldn't visit the beautiful white sand beaches without risking punishment. They weren't allowed to swim in a segregated city until in 1955, a group of them rode in caravans to Lido Key and waded in the water, breaking the color barrier and challenging the rules. The beach caravan was a peaceful integration that was years before the civil rights movement kicked off, Professor Baram said. The 2011 shootings occurred in the heavily minority neighborhood known as Newtown, one of the poorest areas of Sarasota. Professor Baram, who called the tourist shootings horrific, said he was bothered by the media coverage that followed. The media focused on Dateline's Out of Newtown as if it were its own separate place outside the city limits of Sarasota. He said he felt Newtown was suddenly pitted against the rest of Sarasota, us versus them.
And they're creating a divide. And it quickly became clear it was for the sake of tourism, right, for the sake of not making Sarasota a scary place for tourists. And that seemed horrific. The Herald Tribune was creating something that didn't exist. And it was doing it to separate Sarasota from Newtown. And although it was implicit, but it's always implicit in race, separate white Sarasota from black Sarasota. As if Sarasota was a white town, and then there was this other place where bad things happened. It's also just the reality that while there is crime, it's everywhere. There had been other murders in Sarasota, each horrific. But there was no attempt by the newspaper to create divides in those cases. It was only in this particular case.
Sean's trial began in March 2012, right after his 17th birthday. It marked nearly 1 year since James Cooper and James Cazares were killed. In their opening statements, Sean's defense attorney, Carolyn Schlemmer, made it clear. She planned to pick away at the prosecutor's lack of physical evidence. Quote, Sean Tyson did not murder James Cooper and James Cazares on April 16, 2011. The evidence in this case will show no murder weapon or a weapon believed to even be the murder weapon was ever recovered in this case. No one saw Sean pull the trigger, she argued. There is no ballistics match in this case. You will not hear of any ballistics match saying Sean Tyson is tied to this homicide, she continued. There are no fingerprints linking Mr. Tyson to the murders. Under cross-examination with the lead detective, the defense attorney emphasized her point. Detective Todd admitted Sean's fingerprints weren't found at the crime scene or on any of the other evidence, like the empty gun casings that investigators later recovered. The defense's strategy was also to cast doubt on the state's witnesses, Sean's former friends and neighbors who claimed they heard the teenager boast about gunning down the tourists. Some on the stand had long criminal histories themselves or got favors in exchange for testifying. Many of their stories were inconsistent, changing with each interview with the police. You're going to hear a lot about these witnesses, Schlemmer said. You're going to hear about their deals, their benefits, what they got from this case, promises made to them, breaks in their sentences. You'll hear some of the witnesses readily admit to you they lied to law enforcement, and you'll hear pressure and threats used against those witnesses by both the Sarasota Police Department and the state attorney's office. The central question at trial boiled down to who would the jurors believe? Who was credible on the stand? The state called one of its witnesses, 21-year-old Jermaine Bain, who testified that he talked on the phone with his then-friend Sean the night the tourists were shot. The pair lived near each other in the courts. Jermaine described their call to the jury. "Who are those crackers walking past the park?" Sean said abruptly on the other line. Then silence. "Hello? Hello?" Jermaine said. He hung up. Then Jermaine heard the gunshots. A short time later, Sean was back on the phone again, Jermaine testified. He told him to go outside and check out the dead bodies. Jermaine said he refused. Phone record evidence introduced at the trial showed Jermaine and Sean had several brief calls around the hours of 3 and 4 a.m. on April 16th. 19-year-old Marvin Gaines, another part of Sean's social circle in the courts, testified about his encounter with Sean hours after the shooting. It was around 10 a.m. on April 16th when Marvin met up with Sean and their friends in a nearby parking lot. Marvin testified, "He pulled me to the side and asked me, 'Did I hear about the people getting killed back there?' I told him, 'No.' I said, 'Why? What happened?' He said, 'I did it.' He followed Sean back into his apartment and up into his brother's room where Sean pulled out a suitcase. Sean opened it and gave Marvin 7 empty shell casings and asked for a favor. Would Marvin bury them? Marvin said he used a small broken shovel and dug a hole in his backyard. Later that night, after it was already dark, Sean phoned him. Sean told him the gun was hidden under Marvin's bathroom window behind the boards. Again, it was Marvin's task to hide the evidence. Marvin was asked why he decided to hide the evidence for Sean. He made a mistake, he said. He shouldn't have done it. Marvin testified that he retrieved the gun from the hiding spot and then buried it in his backyard by the trampoline. The following day, however, he said he dug it up and passed the gun to another friend, Joshua Bain. About a month after Marvin buried the gun shells, and by this time the gun was long gone, the police knocked on Marvin's door. The first time he was interviewed at the police station, Marvin testified that he didn't reveal the truth about what had happened. "I was scared," he said. "Of what?" the prosecutor asked. "What will come down on me?" Marvin said. He acknowledged that he had been called a snitch once or twice. "What does it mean to be called a snitch in his community?" the prosecutor questioned. "You ain't going to be the same person you used to be," Marvin said. "People are going to look at you different." 3 months after his first police interview, Marvin returned for another round of questioning. This time, he said he was frightened he could go to jail for the rest of his life, and so he relented. He told authorities about the gun and the shell casings he buried. Authorities dug up the casings. Sean's defense attorney went on the offense to point out Marvin's two different version of events. Quote, "When the police first talked to him, he said Sean never did anything. Marvin Gaines is then told, 'You're going to be an accessory to murder, and you know what that means.' Then suddenly, Mr. Gaines is changing his story." 25-year-old Joshua Bain, Jermaine's older brother, revealed that he knew what happened to the missing murder weapon. Joshua said he was on the receiving end as Marvin handed off the .22 caliber weapon. He said he and his friends took action at another man's house. Joshua used a t-shirt to wipe the dirt off the gun, which was clogged with debris. They then scratched the serial number off the gun with a screwdriver. He noted that Sean wasn't present as they tried to make it impossible for anyone to find the weapon. 2 days later, Joshua said he sold the gun for $50 and then used the money to buy marijuana. Months later, Joshua said he still kept watch for the silver gun to resurface in his neighborhood. At this point, he was working with prosecutors and promised to call the police if he ever saw the gun again. The gun hadn't been recovered as the trial went underway. Joshua Bain also gave more insight into Sean's reputation in the neighborhood. He said Sean was rarely seen without his weapon. Sean carried a gun day and night, Joshua testified. If we weren't playing basketball or football, he had it. Sean carried the silver revolver with a red bandana tied around the handle at his hip. The red bandana was a signature look for Sean, he said. He wore one around his neck, too. Joshua first learned the tourist had been murdered in front of his family's home on the news. The next day, he said he ran into Sean, which wasn't unusual since they were close and hung out practically every day. He lifted up his shirt and just showed me the pistol, Joshua said. It was the same .22 caliber revolver with the red bandana, the same one that Joshua said he would eventually sell for $50. Sean's words to him? Dunham, clap, 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 Joshua testified. It was a quote from an obscure movie that he and Sean watched several times together. When someone said, clap, 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 it meant a shootout. Neighbor Wanda Ferrier knew Sean since he was a little boy. She testified that she heard gunshots and then about 10 minutes later, watched Sean climb into the window of his mother's house on April 16th. Sean's face wasn't covered, and Wanda could clearly see it was the teenager who affectionately called her auntie. She said she noticed another boy with Sean, although he didn't enter the window, and instead left. But her story at trial was different than what she told police earlier. Her account to police was chalked with details like seeing Sean running with a red bandana over his face after the shootings. At trial, all she remembered was Sean going through the window. I didn't want to lie and I said I don't remember seeing it, Wanda said on the stand, acknowledging that maybe she was confused and making her version up with what her partner had seen. On cross-examination, the defense pounced, accusing Wanda of lying. I won't call it a lie. I was confused and I admitted that I did make a mistake because I don't want to put nobody's life in jeopardy, she said. Jurors listened to her testimony that was sometimes confusing and full of contradictions. Wanda testified that she never called 911, but the defense attorney confronted her with the call transcript that showed that she did indeed make the call. During the police investigation, Wanda had identified Sean's photograph in a lineup, but refused to sign her name on the back of the document. I don't want to get involved in this, Wanda testified. Her partner, Roger Shavers, testified that he was sitting outside on his porch when he heard the gunshots, and then seconds later, he saw Sean and another young man running down the sidewalk. A red bandana hung around Sean's neck. Roger said he, too, watched Sean climb into the window. But Roger's story had also changed since he first talked to the police. He originally said the bandana covered Sean's face. I can't remember, that's been so long ago, Roger said on the stand. The prosecutor asked if anything could help trigger his memory. I doubt it, but I thought it was around his neck, but I don't know if I can tell you something different, he said. Wanda and Roger moved out of the courts a week after the murders. They no longer felt safe. The defense suggested that it was a deal they got from the state in exchange for their involvement in the case. Detective Todd testified that he called the Sarasota Housing Authority director. I explained the situation to him, that we were concerned about the witnesses' safety, and we made arrangements to move them to a different housing complex, he testified. He said he hadn't promised them anything for their cooperation, that they did it voluntarily. And as for this second young person that several witnesses said they saw with Sean that night, it was another loose end at trial. Robert Eckhart, who now works as a political editor in Austin, Texas, said the trial did not answer many questions about what happened that night.
I never really felt like we got everything figured out there. I mean, there are still a lot of questions about that case in my mind.
The day that Wanda and Roger testified in court, the prosecutor stopped for an abrupt recess. Sean's sister, who had previously been in the courtroom, had sent an angry, profane-filled Facebook message to another witness. "I hope you get a check for taking the stand," part of it read. After that, Sean's sister was banned from attending the rest of the trial. Many of Sean's once close friends and neighbors acknowledged how difficult it was to testify against the teenager. Some said they were fearful of retaliation. Circuit Judge Rick DeFuria tried to keep order. Before 18-year-old Latrice Washington testified, Assistant State Attorney Karen Fravelig asked the television station filming the trial not to broadcast the teen's face on television. The television station agreed to only shoot her hands. She is paralyzed with fear, not just because people from the defendant's family have been coming up to her and calling her a snitch, but also because of the events that took place on Friday, where the defendant's sister threatened another witness, she told the judge. On the stand, Latrice spoke in a soft voice. She nervously rocked back and forth in the chair. The prosecutor asked her to speak up as the young woman recounted what happened when she spent the night at her cousin's home in the projects. Latrice said she saw Sean on his porch with his gun after the tourists were shot. Sean beckoned her over. "Did you guys hear what happened last night?" Sean had asked her. "He said there were two guys walking and they looked like they were going in people's cars," Latrice testified. "Did he say that he was going to rob them?" the prosecutor asked. "Yes," Latrice said. Latrice then recounted the chilling conversation she said Sean had with the two strangers in his neighborhood. The last words the tourists said were, "Please leave me alone. Please let me go. I'm lost." "Did Sean say anything to those young men walking through the projects?" the prosecutor asked. "He said, 'Since you don't have any money, I have something for your ass,'" Latrice said. "That's when he was like, 'He shot one of them in the side and one of them fell instantly. And then the other was crying for his life and he shot him and emptied the clip at him.'" Sean then told Latrice he needed to hide his gun. Latrice went back home and recounted everything she had heard to her mother. Her mother drove her to the police station and she gave a statement to authorities. At times, Latrice stumbled, unsure how to answer on the stand. The prosecutor would then urge her to look down and read her previous statements in order to refresh her memory. This drew protests from Sean's defense attorney, Carolyn Schlemmer. Latrice also became angry during cross-examination, creating a very tense moment on the stand, which required the judge to intervene and remind her not to talk back. The defense attorney returned to Latrice's testimony at the end of the trial. She wanted to make the jury unsure that they could trust her recollections. When the judge gives you that instruction on weighing the credibility of witnesses, he's going to tell you that you may believe or disbelieve any part or all of the testimony of a witness, she said. Did the witness seem to have an accurate memory? A person that jumps out to you on that could be Latrice Washington. Couldn't remember anything. Wanted to read through and look at her statement. Didn't have an accurate memory of the events. Many of the state's witnesses who testified against Sean had long criminal histories of their own. Roger, the eyewitness who saw Sean running after the gunshots, was an 11-time felon. "Thanks for letting me know because I hadn't been keeping track of it," he said when Sean's defense attorney brought it up. The jury also heard Detective Todd's tone as he demanded Sean's friends tell the truth during their police interrogations. For Jermaine Bain, the detective testified, quote, "I think I told him to quit pulling my chain or I was going to F him up, seriously. Obviously, my choice of words wasn't the best, and I should have phrased that differently. My intention, or what I meant by that, was, again, His world that he had known of hanging out in the projects was going to be coming to an end if he continued to lie in this investigation. I wanted to make very clear to him that this was a double murder. I mean, there were two people that were dead, and I knew he had information that he wasn't telling me. On cross, Sean's defense attorney said, "Let's talk about Jermaine and Joshua for a moment." On May 15th, 2011, a month after the murder, the brothers were arrested during a traffic stop. Joshua Bain avoided up to 10 years in prison in exchange for his testimony against Sean. He instead got probation. On the final day of trial, prosecutor Karen Fravelig reminded the jury that it was Sean Tyson on trial, no one else. It's not Joshua Bain, it's not Jermaine Bain, it's not Marvin, it's not Latrice, it's not Wanda, she said. So I'm going to ask you to keep your eyes on the ball and focus on the real reason why we are here in this courtroom today and have been the last 10 days. Because Sean Tyson murdered two young men back on April 16th, 2011. She defended the investigators' tough approach and their threats with jail time unless witnesses cooperated. Does it take a while to get those guys to tell their story to tell the truth? She asked. Of course it does. Jermaine Bain, Joshua Bain, they're not Boy Scouts. They're the people who live where the crime was committed. And those are the people who know what's going on because they're friends of Sean Tyson and he confided in them. There was only one inescapable conclusion, State Attorney Ed Bronski said, as the prosecution rested its case and presented closing arguments. Sean was guilty of murder. The state attorney reminded the jury about what the witnesses had testified to, like how Latrice Washington mentioned that Sean told her he shot one of the men in the side, an important detail that hadn't been publicly released at the time from the autopsy. Like how Wanda Ferrier and Roger Shavers were both eyewitnesses who saw Sean after the gunshots rang out. Like how Sean's friends testified about his red bandana and his gun that he usually carried, which fit the description of the person seen in the dark on April 16th. In his final remarks, the prosecutor asked the jury to hold Sean accountable and bring justice to this case. The jury didn't take long to decide Sean's fate. 2 hours later, they reached a guilty verdict. The judge sentenced Sean to a mandatory life sentence in prison with no possibility of parole. For the first time, the families of the victims spoke out.
The English families, the families of the victims, they had been quiet and not spoken to us at all, all the way until the end of the trial after he had been convicted, when they get their chance to speak to him directly, and they were just destroyed by this.
The photographs of the two men were shown publicly.
You know, we saw pictures of them like growing up, this very nice sort of middle class upbringing with parents and family members who clearly doted on them. And, you know, when they were in their 20s and they'd done some traveling and they were really sort of outgoing, you know, people. And just the anger that was still in the voices of these people while they were talking directly to Sean Tyson. And I remember, I read it in the story, but I remember so clearly one of them just looking at him and going, you know, the stupid thing about what you did is you didn't just ruin their lives, you ruined your own. Which was, really just a heated and direct way to put it, I thought. I mean, those words stick with you.
The Sean Tyson case doesn't end there. 2 months after Sean's sentence, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 2012 that juveniles cannot automatically receive life in prison without parole because it's cruel and unusual punishment. According to law professor Irene Sullivan, this ruling had been years in the making.
Well, it starts with a whole, like most Supreme Court cases do, some precedent and some other rulings that set the stage for these rulings. And the Supreme Court ruled that the mentally retarded people could not be put to death for crimes they committed either while they were mentally retarded or while they were serving sentences, death sentences. Then the Supreme Court ruled that juveniles could not be put to death, be given a death sentence for crimes committed while they were juveniles. So those were precedents. So the only thing left for juveniles, the most major sentence that they could receive would be life without parole. In other words, life in prison with no chance of ever leaving prison for a crime they committed when they were under 18. So Justice Kennedy wrote the most important decision, the Graham decision, we call it, in I think 2009 or 10, that said that juveniles who commit crimes other than murder cannot receive a life without parole sentence because basically it takes away all the hope. And that was in my mantra at the end of it. Juveniles should have hope. Okay, kids should have hope. So Justice Kennedy said that young people deserve some hope and they have to have hope in their lives. And I thought this was so important when I was a juvenile judge and as a law professor, that there has to be hope in kids. The kids can't be hopeless. So that was the first decision, but that applied to crimes other than murder. And then the next decision was in the Miller case a few years later. Justice Kagan wrote the opinion and ruled that even in crimes involving murder, first degree, second degree murder, felony murder, that kids couldn't automatically, and this is really important, automatically be sentenced to life without parole. Because a lot of states have, in Florida, like if you kill a police officer, you're automatically sentenced to life without parole. So Justice Kagan, in that opinion, the Miller opinion, said that there had to be a sentencing hearing so the juvenile could put on evidence of mitigation factors and so on, as well as the victim's family. So you couldn't do it automatically, like right after a jury verdict. And then the Montgomery case, which followed that a few years later, said that this was applied retroactively. So that's why we have all these resentencing hearings in Florida and in other states, because some of these men, they're almost all men, have been in prison for 20, 30 years because they were sentenced as juveniles to life without parole for crimes committed as juveniles, as life without parole. So they're getting resentencing hearings, some of which resulted in a full hearing where mitigation evidence is permitted to be introduced, but the judge still decides, I'm sorry, but you're going to get a life without parole sentence. So that's still legal as long as there's a full hearing on it. It's legal for murders, for juveniles who commit crimes when there were juveniles that are rise to the extent of murder. So that kind of explains it. So it's Graham, Montgomery, and Miller are the key cases. Graham, Miller, and Montgomery, rather, are the key cases in this evolution of juvenile sentencing.
On the heels of the Supreme Court decision, Sean sought to have his conviction overturned or to get a new sentence. An appeals court upheld Sean's conviction, but ordered him to face a judge again for a new sentencing hearing. Sean's sister advocated for him to receive a lighter sentence in her letter to the court in 2016. She wrote, quote, "Everyone in Newtown knows Sean, and they still find it hard to believe that he was convicted of this crime. Being only 16 at the time of this crime, he was still a child with so much more learning and growing to do. Life without parole gives him no choice whatsoever. My prayers and condolences go out to the victims' families. I'm so sorry for the loss of your loved ones. All families are affected in this case." In June 2016, Sean, now 21, returned to the courtroom with a different circuit judge than the one who originally sentenced him in 2012. His defense attorney pushed for a sentence of 2 terms of 40 years, the minimum allowed. The Sarasota Herald Tribune documented Judge Charles E. Roberts's words before he resentenced Sean during the hearing. Quote, "On April 16th, 2011, Sean Tyson killed in cold blood two young men who posed no threat. The defendant's motive was robbery, but when he realized he would not get what he wanted, he made the conscious decision to kill both victims. These crimes have had a devastating impact on the family of the victims and the victims' friends. This was not a spur-of-the-moment, one-shot event. I have not been persuaded, based on everything I've heard, that he can be rehabilitated. He then issued the new ruling. Sean was resentenced to serve two consecutive life terms in prison. No parole. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think about this case. If you were on the jury, how would you have voted? Do you think the system worked? How do you think the way the case was portrayed in the media affected the outcome, if at all? And what did you think of his resentencing? Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. This episode was researched and written by Gabrielle Roussan. That's all for today. Thanks for listening. Until next time.